Hey there, listeners. Vermont Edition co-host Michaela Lafrac here. The podcast you're about to listen to has been edited and condensed for clarity and brevity. Enjoy. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Today on the show, we're bringing you the news from the State House in Montpelier. We recently passed the midway point of the legislative session, called Crossover Day. That's when bills have to pass out of at least one committee in one chamber. If they don't, they are very unlikely to become law this session. It's a complicated process, and some of the major legislation on the docket this year is complex as well. So today on the show, we'll be joined by three political reporters who are well-versed in the big issues that are playing out under that golden dome this year. First, we have with us Bob Kinzel, Vermont Public's senior political reporter. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Mikhail.
Thanks for joining us. We're also joined from Montpelier by Sarah Meerhoff, a reporter with VT Digger. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michaela.
And last but not least, here in the studio with me in Colchester is Calvin Cutler of WCAX. Hey, Calvin.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. Well, I'm so glad to have all three of you here. All right, let's start with the basics here. Bob, Crossover Day. What is it? How does it work?
Well, Michaela, as you mentioned, crossover, a bill has to come out of their so-called Committee of Jurisdiction by March 17th. Now, some of these bills have to go to the Appropriations Committee, or some of them have to go to the Finance or Ways and Means Committees. And so if they had to go to a money committee, they had to be out by last Friday. And that's a pretty hard and fast rule. But it is possible for the sponsors of a bill to go to the respective rules committees and say, we didn't make it for crossover, but this is really an important priority, so please, could we get an exemption? That happens every once in a while. Also, what you see happen is the language of a bill can get tacked on to another bill. So in a way, two bills are brought into one. And so that happens, or at least provisions of it happen quite often. And we should also mention that bills that didn't make the crossover deadline, it's not like they're dead for the year. Some committees will continue to work on those bills because the sponsors will at least want to get one chamber to agree to the legislation before the year is out. But generally, I would say the crossover deadline is pretty strict with a little wiggle room.
Okay, so they might be gone, but they're not forgotten. Well, during the show, we're going to be talking a lot about what Governor Scott's views are on all of these bills. He vetoed quite a number of bills last year. This year, Democrats have a really strong majority in both chambers. Calvin, can they override basically anything that Scott vetoes?
Yeah, I mean, definitely on its surface, you know, with especially having 104 Democrats in the House of Representatives, on its surface, yes, it sounds like Democrats may be able to override just about any veto that the governor may issue. But I think, you know, as we see the full House of Representatives vote on more policies over the coming weeks and months, you know, we might start to see, you know, maybe not necessarily a fracturing within the Democratic Party, but it's not a, you know, every Democrat doesn't vote the same way. Some may lean further to the left, some may be more of a centrist or a moderate. And so because of that, there might be some that actually do align with Governor Scott and his priorities and his fiscal tendencies, if you will. So just because they have the two-thirds majority needed to override doesn't necessarily make it a slam dunk. So I think especially some of those key votes coming up, that's what I'll be looking for.
And Bob, you've been reporting on the legislature for a long time now. Do you notice, like, during this period in the session, does the energy start to shift in the State House? Are people running around with, like, chickens with their heads cut off, or is it still kind of business as usual?
Well, there definitely is a higher energy level because you've got bills coming through the crossover deadline. And so what's happening is for the bills that didn't have to go to the money committees, they're going right to the floor. That's what we experienced last week. And coming up this week will be a lot of the bills that did go to the Ways and Means Committee or the Appropriations Committee. So it ends up with a lot of floor action. I mean, last Thursday, I think the House was on the floor until 11 o'clock at night. They dealt with four or five major pieces of legislation during the course of the day. So what we see at this time of year is a lot more floor action than we usually see at the legislature.
Well, let's dive into some of these bills. And I would love to start with paid family and medical leave, because just late last week, the House approved a bill that would grant Vermonters 12 weeks of paid leave to care for a newborn or a sick family member, and they would get 90% of their salaries while they're doing it. Sarah, this has long been a priority of House Democrats, right?
It has been, yes. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I think the thing that stands out about the House version of the paid family leave bill is that it's, number one, the most generous paid family and medical leave bill proposed in a state legislature in the country as of right now. It's also goes further than the Senate version. And I know you didn't ask about the Senate version, but I'm going to go there.
No, we're going to do both. So, yeah, let's do it now.
The Senate version is restricted just to new parents, as opposed to the House version includes paid family medical leave for new parents, as well as someone caring for a sick family member. And so that's a very big difference between the two. There's also a difference in the wage reimbursement between the two. The House would offer more wage reimbursement than the Senate version.
Okay. And with the House version, the annual cost looks like it's just shy of $120 million. How do they propose paying for that?
One of the big things in the House version is instituting a new payroll tax. I mean, we also – these numbers are in flux right now. And so I'm actually not positive that we have at this point – wait, hold on. I'm looking at my notes. Okay. The House version is estimated that they would raise a payroll tax by 0.55%. And that would adjust on an annual basis depending on the number of claims that they get. I think the major thing with this program is that it's very unknown, right? It's hard to predict how many people will take advantage of it. And so they've built some flexibility into the numbers there.
Yeah. Okay, so a payroll tax, about 0.5% split, I believe I read, between employers and employees.
Yes.
Calvin, I'm guessing when we say the words payroll tax, that the Governor Scott is out there somewhere saying, no.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's definitely weighed in on this before. In fact, the Scott administration right now is moving forward with their own voluntary plan that's going to be rolled out in several stages. And right now, I believe it's open to state employees. But eventually, the idea is for people to opt in. But the governor, and it's not just with paid family leave, but for others, he's staunchly opposed to new taxes and new fees on Vermonters because he says, especially now during the high inflation times, that Vermonters just can't afford it. It's worth noting that, you know, the governor has vetoed paid family leave plans in the past. So certainly, I think the governor's position, he's dug in. He says, we have a plan. We're moving forward with it. But I think one of the biggest questions, as Sarah alluded to, is, you know, we have this conversation about paid family leave moving forward in the House, now over to the Senate, and then we have this child care conversation happening in the Senate, which will be moving into the House. And those are two really big spending priorities and policy priorities of the Democratic majority. And I think one of the biggest questions moving forward over the next 3 weeks, 4 weeks, is going to be, you know, is there enough room in the budget for both? And how do we fund that? What does that balance look like? Mm. So I expect that to be one of the bigger themes going forward.
Mm. And Bob, I'd love for you to weigh in here because I know you've been following this issue closely this year as well as in years prior. You know, this phrase, paid family leave, is not something new to the Vermont legislature. How are you seeing them wrangle with these bills this year?
I think it's going to be fascinating, Michaela, to see how the House and Senate resolve this issue. On one hand, the House really feels that paid family leave is a top priority for this session. They feel very strongly about it. And as Sarah mentioned, it's, I think, the most generous leave bill in the country, 12 weeks of leave time, 90% of your salary. operating costs of almost $120 million. You take a look at the Senate, and their approach is very, very different. They want to limit it to new parents. It's a scaled-down program. I should mention that the House bill would also result in 65 state employees running the program. So this is a big, big expansion. Wow. And I think what we're seeing is just a different priority, a very different priority from the House and the Senate, as Calvin mentioned, on paid family leave and child care. And the question is, can they resolve both of those? I find it difficult to believe that they're going to be able to pass both bills in their entirety. Mm. Now, maybe it'll be a scaled down version of each one. But I think it is going to be interesting to see how in terms of raising taxes, what's acceptable, what's not, how much spending is okay. And, you know, I think it also points out to some degree the dangers of having a big majority in the House and the Senate for the Democrats. You usually would think, wow, you've got 50 or 60 extra Democrats. That's a good thing. Well, it can be a bad thing in that it gives the representatives an opportunity to say, well, this bill doesn't go far enough, so I'm not going to support it. Or this bill goes too far, so I'm not going to support it. It's not like you've got a 10-vote majority where everybody has to toe the line. So I think it's going to be one of the most interesting things to happen in the next couple of months to see what the final determination is for child care tax credits, and paid family leave.
Mm. Michaela, could I add something?
Please jump
Bob
in here, Sarah.
To, the state workers that would need to be hired in order to build and carry out this program. And so one of the big costs associated with the House proposal is not just the benefits being doled out on an annual basis, but also the startup. And so for the first couple of years, even just building out that state infrastructure and building essentially a new department to carry out this benefit, last I saw estimated at $111.5 million. And Governor Scott's administration has countered and said, number one, that's a lot of money. But number two, I mean, 65 new state employees were already facing a workforce shortage in
Vermont.
I think
to the tune of around 800 open positions in state government. That's what his press release said, which was a kind of shocking number to me.
Yeah. And so there's another question of where in the world are we going to get these workers?
Mm, right. Well, speaking of workers, a different kind of worker, child care workers, and this larger child care bill, not necessarily larger, it's a different child care bill that's in the Senate, also tries to address issues of child care cost and, you know, making it more affordable for child care centers to pay their employees a livable wage. Sarah, could you speak a little bit to those other elements of that bill?
So the Senate child care bill is really interesting, I think, because there in a previous version, there was a proposal to institute all-day public preschool for children 4 years old and up. Mm. And that's been struck from the bill. That's been eliminated. The daycare industry really came out in force and said this would devastate us because children, the older children within daycare facilities, really kind of subsidize the infant care and the very young child care because that is very resource intensive. I mean, I think anyone who is a parent would be able to attest how resource intensive it is to care for an infant. And so if you think about a child care facility with taking care of multiple infants, you know, you have a smaller ratio of workers to children, you know, fewer children per worker. And so these daycare facilities, which are already struggling, came out and said, if you take away you know, the older children who really help pay for our bills, this is going to devastate us. And so that portion, the universal pre-K, has been taken out of the Senate bill. Now, essentially, what they're doing is proposing to increase the amount of state money that goes into Vermont's existing child care subsidy system that we have in place, the stipends that families can get. And so What they're proposing is to raise the income cap to 600% of the federal poverty line. You'll be able to get a partial subsidy if you are under 600% of the federal poverty line. That's $180,000 for a family of four. Mm. I think a lot of people, though, still have concerns with when you have a child care bill of $20,000 a year and you're getting $5,000 from the state. That's still a lot of money coming out of your pocket.
Yes. And Calvin, I've also noticed that there's a ton of activism around this bill. You know, it has a lot of associated costs that people are very concerned about. But, you know, the folks that are pushing for it are really well organized and really passionate. There's a big rally coming up. Is that right?
There is. And in a couple of weeks. And, you know, a lot of it has been organized by Let's Grow Kids, which is this advocacy organization that their sole purpose from the get-go has really been to try to shore up and bolster our child care system. And they see it as the one of the core issues to Vermont's economic, workforce, and demographic challenges of you know, parents not being able to find affordable, high-quality childcare. You know, as you mentioned, there is that rally coming up. This is going to be moving through the House in the coming weeks. So I think they're really looking to ramp up support and ramp up the activism for it. But certainly it's one of the biggest issues, at least in terms of, you know, human services and increasing the social safety net this legislative session.
Mm. And before we wrap up this part of our conversation, Bob, I do want to ask you about one proposal that is meant to help pay for all of this, and that is nixing the relatively new child tax credit. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And, you know, Michaela, I think this also shows sort of the differences in priorities between the House and the Senate that we were talking about for paid family leave and child care. Now, here's a provision that was put into place last year that was a top priority for the House that basically gives $1,000 for each child under five. And it's a continuation of a federal program that was put in at the beginning of the pandemic that was $3,000 per child. This is a program that a lot of people think has been very, very effective in helping reduce childhood poverty. And as I mentioned, it was a top priority for the House last year. They actually had a bigger tax credit and they scaled it back in order to reach a compromise with the Senate. Now the Senate wants to do away with it. I can't believe that's going to be very well received over in the House. It feels like you're taking money from one group and saying, well, we're going to give you some new benefits, but we're going to take away some other benefits. And it just doesn't seem to make a lot of fiscal sense. But that's another issue that's going to have to be resolved.
Mm. The other thing with that proposal to nix the child tax credit, not only I think Bob is right that the House is probably going to scream from the rooftops about that one, but so is the Scott administration. Officials within the Scott administration have said that this is a good, important tax credit that benefits, you know, the most vulnerable Vermonters. And to take that away from that group who already get free childcare due to their, low household income, take away that tax credit that's really helped them to lift them out of poverty in order to put it toward a childcare system that would actually be benefiting, you know, raising the roof to help more middle class families. And then on top of that, instituting a payroll tax on those low-income Vermonters. So the Scott administration is also vocally upset about this one.
Right now we have Chris in Brattleboro. Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I was just curious from the panelists. I've been keeping up on VPR and VT Digger about the legislation this year. And at the beginning of the session, there was a lot of talk about Act 250 reform to address the housing shortage. And I haven't heard any updates on that or whether those who made crossover. And I'd like to hear from the panelists about that, please.
All right, Chris, your wish is our command. Calvin, I'm going to start with you. housing, Act 250, what is happening?
Yeah, it is a very complex and very fast-moving conversation. Act 250 has been one of the key elements to this sweeping housing bill that's been passed through several key Senate committees, and it's actually going to receive a vote in the Senate later this week. Senate Bill 100 looks to essentially reform Act 250 and local zoning ordinances to try to strike that balance between, how do we build responsibly, but also meet the moment and meet the need. The Vermont Housing Finance Agency says that we're going to need about 40,000 units to meet the need. So the latest version, which passed out of the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee, essentially the main component with Act 250 and the Scott administration and the League of Cities and Towns, they're concerned about this, and they have concerns, but it essentially would trigger Act 250 when you build more than 25 units of housing in a 10-mile radius in a 10-year period. That provision has a sunset, or it expires after 3 years. So those changes to Act 250 wouldn't be permanent. But from the governor and from the League of Cities and Towns' perspective, they say that it's not equitable. And in fact, that really would only open up about 3,000 acres or 3,000 square miles of land to development here in Vermont, as opposed to the well over 100,000 square miles in the state of Vermont. So they say that communities like North Montpelier, Marshfield, Island Pond, you wouldn't get those Act 250 exemptions in those downtowns and in those designated areas. So there is some concern about, whether this current version goes far enough. Hmm. But on the other side, there's many in the environmental community, the Vermont Natural Resources Council, and others say that this is getting closer and it's the right balance potentially. Mm. So again, it's very fast moving, but Act 250 is a very it's a hot topic this year. Mm. 53 years old now.
Wow. And as you alluded to a bit, Calvin, one of the goals of many lawmakers who have been working on this omnibus bill is to allow for denser housing in town and city centers, other areas of the state. And we recently had on State Senator Keisha Ram Hinsdale to discuss this bill. She's the chair of the Senate's Housing and Economic Development Committee. Let's take a quick listen to what she said.
When you look at this housing crisis, there's a urban, suburban, and rural component, all three. And so everywhere in the state, it would allow duplexing by right. We've seen numerous articles that say for many seniors especially, the idea of taking a large home that they have, maybe they're only heating one part of it, they're really struggling to stay in that home, finding a way to partition it and cut it in half alone would be a really huge change for the state, not having to go through a bunch of regulations. In fact, Vermonters may not know this, but about 70% of Vermont households are two people or less. And when we think about our big farmhouses, that's a lot to heat and a lot to maintain.
Mm. Well, Sarah, love for you to hear your thoughts here. Calvin just gave us a great overview of this omnibus bill. What are some of the things that you're keeping an eye on with it?
I think one of the interesting components with this one is that we just heard a recording of Senator Keisha Ram Hinsdale. She is the chair of the Senate Economic Development Committee. And the version of S-100 that committee passed really sought to strike the balance between, I don't want to set it up as if environmentalists and municipalities are inherently at odds. Mm-hmm. But in this conversation, they do have competing interests, right? And that bill in its original form did try to strike that balance. Municipalities, groups like the League of Cities and Towns made concessions, and environmentalists made concessions with the Act 250 reforms that were proposed. And then the bill got moved over to the Senate Natural Resources Committee, and they stripped out some of the teeth in the Act 250 reforms. Calvin already talked about the 1055 rule. That was the way that the Economic Development Committee passed that was 2555. That's a mouthful. And what the Natural Resources Committee did was they narrowed that scope very much so. The areas that would actually be subject to that in Vermont. And they also, I think this is really important, they added a sunset clause. And so that would phase out that, you know, loosening of the Act 250 restrictions to 2026. And their kind of rationale for that was to say, this is a very acute problem. Let's loosen the restrictions for a couple of years to build housing. But then let's sunset it so that this doesn't go on in perpetuity. And the Scott administration and, you know, municipal leaders had a press conference recently where, you know, someone with the League of Cities and Municipalities said that we held up our end of the bargain. There are about half of the things in the original version of S-100 that we didn't like, say getting rid of single family zoning. That kind of one could say that that overrides local rule, right? And then now they're kind of playing take backsies with the Act 250 reforms.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Russ in Danby. Russ, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious if you folks might know the status of the bill to eliminate militias in Vermont, how where the status of that right now might be.
Bob, I think you've been following that bill a little bit, have you?
That was a bill that did pass in the Senate, if I remember correctly. Maybe Sarah or Calvin can refresh my memory, but it did pass in the Senate. It was sponsored by Senator Baruth, who is the Senate President Pro Tem. It's now over in the House, and I would have to think that its chances are pretty good.
Calvin, what are you
saying? I believe it's in House Judiciary right now. Yep. The paramilitary camps, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, this is the bill that's aimed at Slate Ridge, but also other paramilitary training camps statewide. This is moving forward. It's in the House. And I think it's interesting when this legislative session, too, there's been, you know, a lot of the policies regarding guns and the Second Amendment, you know, one of the big overarching themes that we've seen is the Bruin Supreme Court decision from last summer, which has really put a lot of the proposed gun changes or firearms changes into doubt. It seems like, though, this one, even with the Bruin decision, this paramilitary training camp bill still is constitutional.
Mm. So. Well, one other bill that just passed the House on Friday that I found really interesting involves universal school meals. Bob, what would this bill do?
This is another big priority for the House. Basically, it would extend the idea that all students at school should be eligible and have access to both breakfast and lunch. You might remember several years ago at the beginning of the pandemic, the federal government put this in place and provided funding for the states to do this, so there'd be no income standards for the program. The federal program lasted for 2 years, and last year the legislature decided to temporarily extend the program for 1 year. So that's why it's up for a debate and discussion again this year. I think it costs around $25 million a year. Governor Scott does not like this bill. He says it's wrong to have taxpayers footing the bill for student meals in families that don't need the assistance. So he likes the income eligibility standards. Supporters say, though, hey, this is a program that benefits all students, and it's wrong to have an arbitrary income line for qualifying for the program. And it also takes away any stigma that might be involved in students participating in the school meals program. So this one, I think, is going to face a veto. It's a popular program. I think people feel it's important for schools to provide these meals for students. Yes, there are going to be some students who will have access to the meals that perhaps don't need that financial assistance, but again, they may not take advantage of it. It's really on a case-by-case basis. So this is another one. I think we're going to be looking at 3, 4, 5 bills that when they finally pass the House and Senate will be facing a pretty strong prospect of a gubernatorial veto.
Mm, very interesting. One other bill that I've seen moving its way through that a lot of people have been keeping an eye on because of all of the changes to Roe v. Wade at the national level is a House bill around gender-affirming care and protecting patients and doctors for other types of procedures, including abortions. Sarah, you've been following this one, right?
Yeah. There are two bills, one in the Senate, one in the House. The House version is pretty narrow in its scope to legal protections. And the way that it works is that essentially it would prevent any Vermont-based doctors from being effectively investigated or subpoenaed or extradited to states where abortion or gender-affirming care or some type of reproductive service is illegal. It protects the doctors from, you know, facing legal repercussions for performing those sorts of procedures within Vermont where it is legal. Now, the scope of it, there's not much that Vermont lawmakers can do to necessarily protect someone once they leave Vermont. And so what that means is that, say, if somebody comes from, we'll throw out there, Mississippi, travels to Vermont from Mississippi to obtain an abortion, for example, and then that patient travels back to Mississippi, Vermont's relatively limited in what it can do to protect that person once they leave Vermont state lines. One of the really interesting things that I thought came up in the conversation around this bill is that even if, say, that patient from Mississippi goes on vacation in Florida, perhaps the Florida governor would be, you know, inclined to, you know, extradite that person back to Mississippi to face prosecution. And so the message, I think, is that Vermont is trying to do what it can within its borders to protect people who obtain these procedures. And I think one of the big ways that it does protect patients is that by essentially kneecapping investigations into these procedures, say from an out-of-state law enforcement agency or an investigation, by restricting a doctor from testifying out of state, that does offer some protection in halting, or not halting, but, you know, kneecapping an investigation, but it's not foolproof.
Mm-hmm. Well, these state level laws around medical procedures, something, you know, we're seeing a lot of debate over, and it reminds me as well of a recent major ruling a couple weeks ago in a lawsuit by a Connecticut woman who wanted to use Vermont's medical aid in dying law, and Vermont officials agreed not to enforce that rule for her. There's also a bill, I think, working its way through the House right now that would expand the right to medical aid in dying to out-of-state residents. So a lot right now, like a lot of the medical care you might want or not want depends on the state that you live in. A lot of that's changing. While we're on this topic of medicine and care, I want to read a question that we got from Charlie in Bennington, who asks, what is the status of the universal primary care bill? It had over 50 sponsors in the House. Is it still on the wall despite all that support? Calvin, have you been following this one?
Yes. And I will have to quadruple check, but to the best of my knowledge, this one did not make crossover. Mm. You know, universal primary care, or a single payer type of financing model for our healthcare system, has been floated in the past. In fact, we tried to roll it out, as we remember, and that project was shelved. You know, the listener is correct. I mean, this one had nearly about a third of the House of Representatives, but it wasn't a priority of leadership in either the House or the Senate. They're kind of, again, focusing on climate change and childcare and paid leave and all of these others. So it didn't necessarily, I think, have the oxygen in the room for it. But that said, though, you know, it's definitely a challenging time for financing and healthcare. We're still moving forward with the all-payer model and, you know, reforming how we pay for healthcare. So that work still continues, albeit maybe not as fast as some within the state would like to see. But in terms of that universal primary care, I believe it was Representative Brian Chena was one of the backers of the bill. I believe that one is not moving forward this session, at least.
So, Bob, I really want to ask you about sports betting. So let's do it. Give us the lowdown. What's going on with sports betting in Vermont?
It's going to happen, Michaela. It definitely is going to happen. Vermont's the only state in the Northeast that doesn't currently allow betting on sporting events. And backers of the bill say, hey, we got thousands of people in Vermont who are going to New York State or New Hampshire or Massachusetts to place their bets. So it's happening. So why not get some revenue from it? And this is very different types of betting than I think a lot of people are used to unless you're involved in sports betting right now. This is not, gee, will the Red Sox beat the Yankees? No. It's how many foul balls will the Red Sox hit in the fourth inning? How many walks will the Yankee pitcher give up in the eighth inning?
Zero.
We're talking about events that happened during the course of the game. There was a bet on the coin toss for the Super Bowl. What color was the Gatorade going to be? And what's really interesting, I think, is that 50%, it's estimated that 50% of all sports betting takes place during the game itself. So it's not people betting ahead of time on the winner of the game. It's an active, very active interaction with the sports event and betting during the game. Who will score the next basket for the Celtics? And you've got a choice. And so the major leagues love this sports betting because it keeps people involved in the game. They're watching the game. Yeah, I mean, they're probably invested in the outcome of the game to some degree, but they're very interested in betting, and they can continue to make bets throughout the entire game. So it's got a lot of interest in Vermont. It would be controlled by the Department of Liquor and Lottery. Up to 6 sports betting companies would be allowed to operate. It would raise, when it's fully implemented, somewhere between $10 and $15 million a year. It'll be interesting to see if that money gets dedicated. Right now, our lottery funds go into the education fund. That makes some people feel a little better about gambling. Will they do the same thing here? I'm not sure. Governor Phil Scott likes this bill. He buys the argument of, hey, it's happening. Why not take advantage of it? It's passed the House. There's a companion bill in the Senate. And I think supporters of this bill really want to get it through this year.
Interesting. Well, I guess next March Madness could look a little bit different if this passes. I want to take a sharp right turn here away from sports betting and towards a big bill. A lot of people are debating right now, the Affordable Heat Act. It grew out of the Clean Heat Standard, which died last year. And we recently had State Senator Becca White on our show at the end of February to talk about the Affordable Heat Act and this impact that fossil fuel heating is having on the environment. Let's take a quick listen to Becca White.
Vermonters, unfortunately, we have the highest per capita carbon emissions in New England. So while we might be a small state, we are a part of the difficult challenge of we produce carbon per capita more than, as I said, any state in New England. And I like the idea of a regional approach. I mean, that's what we see with REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Inventory. But what I see as our opportunity as a state is to prioritize Vermonters now, because the status quo isn't working.
The status quo isn't working. Sarah, can you talk through a little bit of this bill, the Affordable Heat Act S5, and what it hopes to accomplish?
Michaela, could I punt this one to Calvin?
Yes,
actually?
You may. Yeah, punted, no, Calvin. No, let's do it.
No problem. I mean, certainly this is one of the biggest climate bills of this legislative session, or actually of the past few years, and it's all born out of the Global Warming Solutions Act, which passed back in 2020 and set strict benchmarks for our greenhouse gas reductions. In fact, they're requirements we have to meet. And so this aims to reduce emissions from the thermal sector, buildings, businesses, our houses, et cetera. And it essentially sets up a performance-based system where fuel dealers can buy and sell clean heat credits that they can earn for installing eco-friendly cold climate heat pumps and weatherization and other forms of reducing our carbon emissions from our homes. But this one, as you know, you mentioned last year, it was vetoed by the governor. It was sustained by the 99 votes in the House. So it's moving forward this year. The conversation is a little different. A lot of people are still trying to wrap their heads around, you know, how would this work? Who is an obligated party? How much does a clean heat credit cost? And so the latest version that was voted out of the Senate, there was an amendment from Addison County Senator Chris Bray, who's the sponsor of the bill. Essentially, it would delay the implementation of it for 2 years so a new legislature would actually be voting to implement it. And in those 2 years, there would be a study to, you know, rate to answer those questions. How much would this cost a gallon of fuel oil? What is the cost of a clean heat credit? Who pays for this thing ultimately? And what would the impact be on low-income and marginalized Vermonters? Because as of right now, that's certainly the biggest challenge is, and the biggest question for this is, what does this mean for rural Vermont, people that live out in Roxbury or out in Island Pond or et cetera, that, you know, don't have access to weatherization or some of these other forms of home heating? And then, of course, there's that the question about our workforce. Do we have the capacity to install, you know, that many clean heat pumps over over a few years? So I think there's a lot that is still happening with this bill, a lot of conversation we're going to be seeing in the House. I think as we approach the second half of, or as we're now in the second half of this session, we can expect to see this is one of the ones that's going to be coming down on the House side in the next few weeks, just so they can debate it and move this before the end of the session, where, again, paid leave childcare and others will certainly be in the spotlight. So it's a complex conversation.
Hmm. Bob, your thoughts here?
Yeah, Calvin, I had a question for you. Maybe this has been resolved, but it seems like another big disagreement between the legislature and the governor's office is, will a future legislature have to come back and actually vote on the details of the recommendations of the Public Utilities Commission, whatever they put together, and different kind of fees and taxes and however the whole thing is put together in the next 2 years? Does that have to come back to the full legislature or not? And you'd think that this would be a fairly easy question to answer, but I keep hearing from the governor's office, this bill does not do that. And I hear from the lawmakers, oh, yes, it does. And there's a provision that I think that could be read two different ways, and that's this. This is a direct quote. The commission shall not file proposed rules with the Secretary of State and issue any orders implementing the clean heat standard without specific authorization enacted by the General Assembly. Well, that could be bill form. We have to vote on all the details. And the governor's office would say it also means it could be approved by the Legislative Administrative Rules Committee, which is a very small group of people. Can you add any clarity to this for me?
Bob, I think that's ultimately that is the core question right now that is driving the governor's concerns, but also the advocates on this issue too. This is that question that you just raised is the one dividing factor. And I think there isn't really clarity right now. The way that the bill is written, you can interpret it either way. The Scott administration reads it one way, backers of the bill read it another. So I think, you know, that's definitely something that we'll probably be seeing a lot of debate on as it moves through the House of where is that clarity and who actually has to sign off on this thing.
Hmm. Well, let's squeeze in one more call here. We have Leanne in Ludlow. Leanne, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. I wonder what's happening with, there's a bill to create a retirement plan that employees, the money would be deducted out of their paychecks and put into like a similar like a 401k. And they say that the employer would not be matching it. It would just be to the employee, from the employee and to the employee.
Mm. Sarah, Bob, have either of you been following these pension changes?
There's a new, I believe our caller was referring to a new bill that's been introduced very recently. It's really being spearheaded by State Treasurer Mike Pichek. I'm unfortunately not positive on where those talks are as of right now because it was introduced, I'm talking like a week and a half ago if we're thinking of the same bill. I have asked the governor about his thoughts on that, and he said he was concerned with making such a move mandatory as opposed to an opt-in sort of option.
Mm. Interesting. All right. Well, we only have a couple minutes left, so I'm going to give each of you a chance to do a little grab bag question here. Either one bill you're really excited to keep an eye on that we haven't talked about yet, or a bill that died that you were kind of surprised, lost some steam in the legislature. Calvin, we'll start with you.
I think, you know, in terms of things to look forward to going forward, the yield bill, I think, is going to be one of the more consequential bills of this session. Of course, during town meeting day, everybody voted on local school budgets and town budgets, and the yield bill is what's going to determine the statewide property tax rate. They are expected to go up, I believe, to the tune of 8% for homeowners, but this year we also have a surplus in the education fund to the tune of $90 million. So I'm curious as to where lawmakers will be investing that, whether that will go to buy down property tax rates, whether it will go toward school meals or PCB remediation and cleanup. So that's what I'll be looking forward to over the next few months, really.
All right. Sarah, you're up next.
I'm so glad you asked this question. I did a story last week on right to repair, and specifically a bill in the House Agriculture Committee that would compel manufacturers of agricultural and forestry equipment to make parts and diagnostics and manuals available to people to be able to either repair their own ag and forestry equipment or, you know, hire a local mechanic. The way it is right now is that manufacturers keep a very tight lid on who is able to obtain those parts and those, you know, components, forcing owners of those pieces of equipment to go to, say, the John Deere mechanic, which
sorry,
is far
we
more
have just a couple minutes, a couple seconds left here.
It's a good bill that I'm interested in.
We'll keep an eye on that, the right to repair, what happens next with that, perhaps next legislative session. And Bob, last one to you.
Very quickly, an expansion of the bottle bill to include all those water plastic bottles that people consume and use every day. This would be a biggest expansion of the bottle bill since its inception 50 years ago, and it'll be on the House floor this week.
Well, Vermont Public's Bob Kinzel, VT Diggers, Sarah Meerhoff, and Calvin Cutler from WCAX, thank you to all of you. I've learned so much during this roundtable.